Bhakti. Jai Om Vishnu, Paramahamsa Prajapati, Siddhimata Vangri, Siddhi Bhakti Siddhanta, Sirasa Siddhi Komaraj ki, Sira Namachada Hari Rasa Kor ki, Prem Seho Si Krishna Titani Pabuni Tinanda Sita Doita Gurhar Si Vasari Govindi ki, Si Si Radha Krishna Saima Sundarada Kundagiri Govardhana ki, Vindavindam ki, Madhuya Dham ki, Navadiv Dham ki, Jamuna Mai ki, Ganga Mai ki, Tulasi Devi ki, Bhakti Devi ki, Samaveda Bhakti Vindi ki. All glories to the assembly of devotees. All glories to the assembly of devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Guranga. So we have a welcoming and a appreciation that there's so many new little souls who've come into the community. And as they go through their maturation, their rites of passage to samskaras, we like to give our blessings, our love, and to be excited in great anticipation as we observe these special souls enter into the world and gradually grow. Community is so important, especially as each generation is satisfied, is protected, cared for, and guided. As one of the significant aspects of samskaras, the rites of passage as people normally refer to, is that it reminds us of what we all should be doing or thinking about in terms of how we are connected with each other. As the living entities get older, of course the children are so small, the baby we're going to give grain to today, first grain. As we have these rites of passage from birth to vivaha, to marriage, to death, that things that are most important should never be done alone. They should be done in celebration. And should be done in such a way that the greatest amount of blessings can be associated or can accompany the actual degree. That it should be associated with that person who's undergoing his or her, and we say ultimately the spiritual journey. Because really, life is to prepare us for a glorious death. Or life is to prepare us for once and for all getting out of material bodies and being able to enter into the spiritual realm. So therefore, every accomplishment, every achievement, every aspect of growth should really add to that. And so in that sense, every real sense of growth is to be spiritual, or to enhance our spiritual life. So in a little while after we give the grain, I'm going to, again, continue sharing some meditations from my newest book, Die Before Dying. Today's meditation will be a little different, as it will address the relevancy, will be relevant to our, to our samskara. So I'm going to give some special attention to the women or to mothers. Actually, I was talking to one Guru Kula girl last week, and she asked for blessings, and blessings for procreation, for bringing in forth a new child. And so I says, no problem. What do you want, a boy or a girl? She said, another boy. And I thought, interesting. Normally if you have a boy already, you would want a girl, perhaps. And I thought, why? In my mind, I thought, why another girl? I had to give an answer. She says, well, it's harder to find good husbands for girls. And I was thinking, well, hopefully if you do have two boys, you'll make them good men so they'll be good husbands for, whatever girls that they choose. But I also wondered to what degree it had to do with, acculturation or acculturation due to the society, that we're in. Because everyone knows that men are the most powerful. We have the money and we have the weapons. And whoever, in today's society, whoever's got the money and the weapons, they have the power, right? They either buy you out or they force you out. After all, power is what means everything. So we want to look at this in a little while. And first, if we can bring up the baby. The baby is what? Revati, is it? Prem. Revati Prema. And it's the baby of Brinda and also Gurvani. Let me turn you to the side. So you can see Mother over there. You can see Mother also, huh? They're all here with you. This is the mother who's taking the picture. And the father. And I think she wants to get a lecture today. He said, I know this guru. He's going to speak some nice things about women, huh? Said, but I don't know, it's contradictory because he doesn't have a wife. So if he really thinks all these nice things about women, why he doesn't have a partner? What is her age?
7 months.
7 months now? It's a mess. She definitely wants to speak. You want to say something? So you're sitting at the microphone and you're supposed to... You know how this thing works, huh? So in the last life, she had a lot of chance to use these things. Huh?
She was a famous singer.
We have the grain. It's good. Can you bring it forth? And strong. Oh, my God. Okay, this proves what I'm going to talk about today. You know, the Bhagavad Gita mentions how the more core qualities of the girl comes from the father, and the more core qualities of the boy, you know, comes from the mother. And so, you know, very distinct things that we have in terms of our attributes and characteristics obviously come from both parents, especially, you know, when the parents are sharing and actually nurturing together. But especially in a girl, some of the core qualities will be from the father. That means that she has a good... Oh, she's grabbing it. She's strong. This will be the first time that she's taking some grain, solid food. Unbelievable. She said, stop all the talking, feed me. So the idea is that the priest gives the first grain to the child. So the first solid food that she has, it's blessed, and she takes it in the assembly of Vaishnavas. So many of the core qualities of the child will be in relationship to mother and father, but very significantly, the father. She has a good father. She's going to particularly look for a husband who has similar type of qualities. If she has a good father, she'll feel a certain kind of security, you know, in her life. And if not, then of course she'll be a feminist and she'll hate men. She'll learn karate. She will carry a grudge. And I think I'm going to have to feed her soon. Okay, you better speak in Indian, huh? What can we do both?
Haribo.
Now, notice, I'm trying to feed her, but she's trying to feed herself. So you have a strong, independent girl here. She says, well, you're going to talk about the strength of women, so therefore, she has to show that women don't have to fully depend on men, even though they'll pretend to. Look at her. She's awesome. I've never seen like this. She won't let it go. I'll give you some more. Okay. She said he took it away.
I'll hold her so
okay. And let me give you just one more time, okay? Unbelievable. Not even. Okay. Done. Rebati Frey McGee. Dayal, how much your blessings? She's just 7 months old, huh? Thank you. I was just wondering how you guys so ugly but do such a wonderful, beautiful girl. Now I know you have mystic powers. Some of the things I wanted to discuss today, because, you know, these discussions are going on a lot in terms of the roles of women and men. And it's wonderful because men and women, you know, are so diversified in so many ways. And that's the beauty, and that etiquette is there and should be honored, because you create synergy based on diversity. Healthy diversity produces the greatest productivity. When people are very similar only, then of course they agree and they share something. But something very special takes place when people are able to have unity with diversity, because that diverseness will allow each one to bring something special, that if unity is there, then it acts to complement each other and allows each person to be more than what they would normally be with or by themselves. And so much of marriage or relationship is to become more whole, or to have someone definite in your corner who somehow shares similar values, and someone who is a team player, a formal team player. We all look for friends, we look for associates, we look for mentors, we need mentors to guide us, and we need friends to be able, you know, to be able to confide in. It's like we say in Pitti, or the principles of love, so much based on a friendship, an intimacy of being able to reveal your mind and to share your mind. And people who don't have someone who's close to them they can share their minds to, they cheat themselves, because they minimize some of their humanness, some of their wholeness, some of their spirituality. Those who agree with you, agree with me, they will say certain things that will reinforce us. And that's necessary, and that helps. But where there is some differences, but at the same time the nucleus is God, is Krishna, the nucleus is love, then those differences actually bring more variables, more things to evaluate, to use, to share, in being able to develop as a family, as an institution, and as a world. So we don't want to enter into a mindset of trying to be politically correct where we see women and men as the same. No. We're all the same in terms of same propensities, in terms of the nature of the soul, but no two people are alike. The conception that people are equal, you know, it's a nice sentiment, but people are not. People are different. And that's okay. In a team, people are different. And by recognizing that, you can have an alignment where people are doing different kinds of services, and now you have a better team. But if you try to give everyone the same kind of job, the same kind of work, the same kind of position, it doesn't work that way. And if setup is like that, then it's going to deny this basic qualities. It's going to deny adhikar. It's going to deny sadhachar, or healthy character, healthy potentials in terms of those being accessed. So it's complex, because normally the idea is, yes, people are equal, good sentiment is like that, and let's work on that level. Or people are different, and the tendency is, you know, it's to abuse those differences. So But we want to look at the idea of honoring heterogeneity or differences, and at the same time appreciating unity, homogeneousness, and realizing that as we have different qualities, we recognize those qualities, and we're encouraged by those qualities, then everyone, you know, the whole community benefits. I was saying how men are more powerful in today's society because we control the money and we control, you know, the weapons. And I was kind of joking, but it's also true. Now, I can give you a whole list. Okay. I can give a... that's okay. That's beside from the baby. Maybe I did that on purpose. So, I can give a list of ways, I mean, just to be very gross and practical, ways of how men are more superior. I can give a list, gross list of how women are more superior. But, I mean, well, let's just look at this for, you know, for a minute, in the sense of some of the attributes and qualities. Some of these I shared at the Reverend's institution, you know, last year. I spoke to a really nice group of women there. And in one of my books, I describe some of these things purposely. And I'll start by asking you a question. Who's more educated in America, men or women? If you look at who goes to school, the universities, you see more women to attend universities, you know, than men. Who lives longer in America and all over the world, men or women? In America, women live 6 to 8 years longer than, you know, the average man. Who has greater greater physical perception? Who has stronger eyes, stronger perception in eyesight, men or women? Who has greater sensitivity to smell? This is all physiological, biological science. Women. In sickness, things like I'm dealing now with cancer and heart disease, who are greater to survive with the same quality of disease or the same depth of disease, the same chronic state of disease? Who, statistics proven, are more likely to survive? Women. I mean, if we go from how long one lives, the greater ability at birth to survive, it's women. So from birth to death, as we talk about the body in terms of the smell, the touch, taste, that women have been proven to be stronger, to score higher in these areas. So then, what does it mean when we hear sometimes that women are inferior? Or what does it mean if women have all of these qualities, why they don't control the money and the weapons? The sign that, well, if you go in most places in the world, you see that men dominate. Now, obviously, we find that in most religious institutions and systems, theologies, there's emphasis that men are to protect and provide, that they should take a leading role. Now, I mentioned two things, leading and protection. Protection does mean that you are to lead, or you are to be sensitive and concerned about the dangers, and you are to sacrifice to see that those dangers are not imposed on those who you are protecting. It's like you have the FBI or CIA or Secret Service or whatever, or you have the president's, you know, Secret Service agents. And so they're to be ready to sacrifice. Even to the point, or you have a king, or you have some type of high-level leader of that nature, those around are supposed to be eager, if it comes to it, to sacrifice their own lives, if it comes to a situation where it's them or the person who they're protecting. And so they're in a position of influence and power in the sense that they are to make themselves available to see that whatever is protected or whatever needs to be protected or what goes on, goes on. Bhagavad Gita mentions that when elders and Brahmins and cows and women and children are not protected, not only does the individual who doesn't do those things suffer, but the whole society or community suffers with shorter lifespan, and it opens up a door for so many different kinds of areas of social degradation. But at the same time, as Bhagavad Gita says, how some of the core qualities of the men are connected with the women. So that means women have a tremendous responsibility, as they are the major nurturers most times, to also try to train up their sons as well as their daughters. And as they show by their own example the power of nourishment and chastity, and allow their level of perseverance and dedication, because women are supposed to be able to endure more pain than men also, and even more trauma, in the sense that when there is like death, that women are usually more stronger to deal with it, because in most cases they have a stronger support system. Now, as these women also train up their sons, then we'll have, again, more men who also be more sensitive to being men, and at the same time to being sensitive toward taking care of children and taking care of women. So many men who have very serious issues with women can be traced back to the relationship they had or have with their mothers. In some cases, where men have had very dominating mothers, they have serious issues with women. Or in cases where men have had mothers who weren't there sufficiently for them, they have serious trust issues when it comes to dealing with women. And we can put a whole list of those negative things. But in other cases where men have had the presence of mother and father, have had mother who was encouraging, mother who was chaste, mother who was nurturing, less likely will they be the kind of men who will batter a woman, or less likely will they be the type of men who will not protect a woman. And more than likely, they're even going to look for a partner or wife, or they're going to compare their partner or wife with their mother. And they will be as satisfied to the degree that that woman carries or shows or radiates some of the qualities of his mother. And even if he doesn't bring it up, he's going to be constantly comparing her. My mother did like this, and you're doing like this. Therefore, there's something wrong with you. And he'll feel dissatisfied. And where there was an issue with the mother, when he sees her say or do or act like the mother, internally, he'll go berserk, feel very disturbed, and sometimes unconsciously. So each gender has a whole lot to do with the future generations. Because what we have imbibed and internalized is who we are or what we're becoming. And of course, you know, what we transmit. Let me just, in this same category of just issues or points, let me just read this short list. Male births slightly outnumber female. And there are many reasons for that, because some people are more likely to abort their female girls. But girls have a higher, but boys have a higher death rate if born premature. 22% compared with 15% of girls. Overall, more newborn males die than females, 5 to 4. Sudden infant death syndrome is 1.5 times as common in boys as in girls. Boys are 3 to 4 times as likely to be autistic. Mental retardation affects 1.5 times as many boys as girls. Dyslexia is diagnosed 2 to 3 times as often in boys than in girls. Teenage boys die twice the rate of girls. Boys aged 15 to 19 are 5 times likely to die of homicide. Because of, you know, the macho culture, of course. Boys aged 15 to 19 are 11 times as likely to die by drowning. Maybe because they're more adventurous in some ways, that may be the fact. Boys aged 16 to 19 are nearly twice as likely to die from a car accident. I guess behind the wheel, they get a little more cocky. Men suffer hearing loss twice the rate of women. Women, of course, commit more suicide. And psychologically, one of the reasons is shown is that women feel less in control in their lives. Among people 65 and older, men account for 85% of the suicides. Women try to commit suicide more, but men succeed more. Stroke, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and accidents kill men at a higher rate than women. Three of the greatest issues of sicknesses: heart disease, diabetes, as well as cancer. More likely when they attack the body to take the life of the man, more likely than the woman. American men typically die almost 6 years before women do. I think you see the point here. While men have, let's see, by the age of 36, women outnumber men. Men have fewer infection-fighting T cells and are thought to have weaker immune systems than women. I mean, I could go on and on. But so if we look at the physicality from present-day science, that in almost every area, women are stronger. And as we hear in the Bhagavatam, that women are 9 times more lusty than men. And so that can be looked at in different ways, that women are much more sexually powerful, you know, than men. And that their energy level, as a sannyasi, we don't discuss these things so much, but their propensities in sexual exchange is much more powerful, enduring, than men. And so from birth to procreation to longevity, there's so many things we see that women seem to have a leverage in some ways. Now that also means having so much power, if they use that power and channel that power properly, then how society prospers. If they do not use that power, or if they abuse it, then they become powerful agents of destruction, of Maya, of maintaining unhealthy material culture. And so most people, either men or women, are actively ingrained in material culture. And so therefore, often the more power one has, the more then they will use that in material culture, in Maya. So here we have, again, Shakti, that is not neutral. It's according to how it's used. If it's used in a pious and divine way, then of course it is beneficial for all. And where it is abused, then it creates lots and lots of complexities, chaos, and, you know, and pandemonium. So when that Gurukula girl said that she wanted to have another boy, and I was thinking, why? Of course, everyone has their own desire, their own appetites, and that's her prerogative. But I was thinking, since she asked me for blessings, I was thinking, well, if we have a boy, then why not want a girl? And I thought, well, yes, there's probably a lot of reasons. And the reason she mentioned is that it's harder to find a husband. Well, she didn't say that it's harder to find a good husband. And I thought at the same time, in our own institution, at least for up to the last maybe 2 or 3 years, and it's probably the same now, there are more men than women. And so then why should a girl in our institution have trouble trying to find a husband when there are more men? But what she's really saying is that if I have this good girl, which I expect to have, and I'm going to have trouble if I have such girls in finding proper good husbands for them. And so as a man has seemingly more freedom, if I have boys, then she didn't say, well, I may have trouble having another boy because boys may have trouble finding a good wife. But she automatically knew that men have more freedom in society. I was just thinking as I was showering today, when I meet people, it doesn't matter who it is, I have a tendency, you know, to smile at them. Walking down the streets, an elevator, airplane, it's, you know, just my tendency, you know. It's the way, you know, it's the way I try to manipulate people. Smile at the stewardess, can you give me a good seat, you know. Or walking down a street, walking down an alley. Now, I was thinking, now, if I was in a female body, would and could I afford to do the same thing? And I was thinking, probably not. Because in so many cases of smiling to strangers, even smiling to some people who you know, the tendency is that it can be taken for more than what it is. And one would have to be careful like that. Just a simple thing as a pleasant smile, that more than likely someone could think, she's interested in me, or here's an opportunity, and make much more of it, you know, than what it is. In today's society, we all have to be careful where we go and when we go places, but so many places that we go and we travel alone, that it would be more precarious in the female's body. So a lot of it has to do with lack of protection in society. And it has to do because the Vedic Shastra explains that we can really know a community or society is very piously led and rulership is very wonderful when a very attractive woman can sleep just by a tree. And not even have to worry, you know, about being molested. It's like no place in the world, you know, where a woman can do that, and not be in great fear. 1/3 out of every girl in America, you know, is abused and she's sexually abused. And of course, abuse is on all levels. You know, 1/4, 1/5, the boys. And so much of the abuse is directly from those who are supposed to be the protectors. If you look at the kind of scars that it puts on the women, and you see this tremendous cycle that goes on, and then there it affects the parenting, it affects the relationship with her husband, it affects her own, you know, sense of identity. And then that gets propagated. So here you have a situation where the mother has all these phobias or problems, and then it affects the son, and then the son takes it out on other women, and it just, the cycle goes on and on. So, you know, we're putting a certain edge on this discussion, obviously. You know, we could, you know, give so many statistics about, so many wonderful things about men, but if we match them, we would see that in most areas, women are more prominent. And we see the way society is usually geared. Woman has the same abilities as a man. She doesn't usually get the same salary. She might have to work a little harder. And this is why some educators prefer are against co-education. Because many statistics have shown that when girls are trained with only girls, they excel better. And then when they're with men, then certain things happen. They become intimidated in some areas, etc. But society is integrative society, and it's good for people to associate men and women and different races and different ethnic groups and different religions, because the diversity is the world. We need to learn how, you know, how to be able to cope with diversity. When we hear of Jesus and his parents, we hear more of the position of Mary, especially in Catholicism. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. It's understood that by the mercy of Mother Mary, that one is now available for the mercy of Jesus. We think of so many of the child pastimes of Krishna. We also find that there is more prominence of Maya Soda, Damodar Leela, so many other pastimes, even though Nanda Maharaj was first-class father. But we see the importance of the impact on the male from the woman. Of course, when we talk about the Lord, we talk about incarnations and avatars, you know, it's a different category, but there's that Nara Leela, or the human aspect that we can take notice of. So, of course, we as men have a duty to try to protect our daughters, our sisters, and our mothers. And as we see women as mother, or we see them as daughters, then we have less likelihood to abuse or to misuse them. Someone who's outside of our own wife or whatever. Shouldn't see your wife as your daughter, of course, as your mother in that sense, to its entirety. But if we are able to do like that, then how much we're able to come forth and to be able to offer protection, where then it allows women to be healthy spiritual women. And where we do not do our part, since we are more at the agents of control, having more of the agencies of control under our life space at this time, then we also have to look at so many of the problems that women may have attributed to our own lackings of setting the foundation, offering protection, and being able to complement where everyone is able to benefit. So I want to read my meditation 8 that emphasizes certain things in relationship, you know, to motherhood and to free will in relationship to sons. We all have a free will, and with that free will, we can say yes to spiritual life. We can say yes to why we came here, or we can say no. And that last time before last, I met Prabhupada, and we had that wonderful discussion, and when he embraced me, one of the things I mentioned first, I said, if anything to my service has been good, it's only because of your forcing me. In terms of my own prayers, is not to rely on my own intelligence or lack of it, but to pray that I'm guided and even forced to do the right thing or to do what is necessary. And so I pray to my spiritual mentor and to the Lord in this way. I don't want only the mediocrity that can come from whatever little power or influence that I have. We want, as we said the other day, more than mercy. I mean, more than a law. We want mercy. And so I just said like that to my spiritual master the time before my last time seeing him. And he immediately replied and says, yes. He said, just as my spiritual master forced me, and I have forced you, and that is how the Parampara system goes on. Meaning that the teacher should not just allow the student to do what is comfortable, but the teacher should challenge the student to rise even beyond what they think that they can do. And that brings a loving pressure, loving force. It's amazing what anyone can do when they're encouraged, when they're properly coached, when they're properly guided. And it's amazing what anyone can do when those who they have affection for feel that they can do something of a high achievement. It somehow gives them some empowerment. You know, it actually ennobles the person in so many ways. So in this little discussion, we look at position of mother and position of son in relationship to the son using or abusing his free will. And in these beggar meditations, I've written them for the public, religious public, the pious, the Vaishnava community. But as much I've written them for self purification and self investigation. In my own case, I feel very fortunate that my dominant person in my life, in a very nourishing way, you know, was my mother. And I, you know, the baby in the family, so I had four, you know, sisters who were very much there and supportive. And as I grew up, I had a chance to listen to their conversations and watch them and see how they interact, and I think understand a lot about what women and girls, you know, go through. Now, I'm pretty sure if my mother wasn't the kind of spiritual person she was, you know, I've shared sometimes how I don't know one day that my mother wasn't talking about God. She was always praying intensely. She prayed when she'd get up. She prayed every time she eat. She make us all pray whenever we come to visit her. When we leave, we all had to come together and pray. She made it. She prayed at bedtime. You know, it's like she was just always praying. And even though we had little, she was always, you know, sharing and very eager to share. So obviously certain qualities that she possessed, hopefully, you know, we were all able to, you know, imbibe some of those qualities. Now, if my mother was different, maybe you would hear me speaking different at this time right now. And those women, everybody takes sannyas. Don't worry about women. Mother watches with great concern as we misuse our free will. The title of this. Mother watches with great concern as we misuse our free will. Mothers are very special, for they are nurturers, comforters, and facilitators. They have very special relationships with their sons, as fathers have very special relationships with their daughters. Now, where the mother and the father, or the father is very balanced, you'll see that the father is also, you know, very nurturing, and will extend himself more than, say, the normal, typical, materialistic father. The Vedas explain that mothers normally make a great impact on the personality of the son, and the father greater impact on the core qualities of the daughter. Some of these deeper personality traits of the son are in connection with the mother, and the deeper traits of the daughter are in connection with the father. There are a lot of mothers in pain due to their own son or someone else's son who has put them in anxiety. The wife who was battered by her husband is suffering at the hands of someone else's son. Her own son, who gets angry so fast and resorts to violence repeatedly, puts her and others in great anxiety. In spite of these tremendous difficulties, the mother prays for everyone's well-being. There is a mother out there whose son has been sent to prison. When she goes to visit him and talks to him through the barriers, she cries due to the pain that she feels, and she studies his predicament. She wonders how he could abuse his free will to such an extent. There's a mother out there whose son received so much affection and attention throughout his life. As he got older, she was so excited to watch him mature. However, after he entered adolescence, his entire personality changed. At first, he started coming home intoxicated, hiding what he was doing and what was happening to him. Later, he did not even seem to care if she noticed his intoxicated state or not. She wondered how her son could abuse his free will to such an extent. There's a mother out there whose son has estranged himself from his family. He is constantly rushing off to join his friends and to go to various events. Even when he agrees to come home for a meal, he's almost never consistent. Whenever the family sits at the table to eat, his seat normally remains vacant. Even when he joins in on those rare occasions, he leaves after a few minutes and comes at the end of the meal. The family members, especially the mother, so much want him to be included in the family, in the family affairs. She wonders how her son could abuse his free will to such an extent. There's a mother out there whose son has a chronic physical disease. She's taken him to so many doctors and healers, and although they each will say that they can surely cure him from his sickness, it returns in one form or another. She sees so many other parents who have healthy children, but her poor son is suffering so tremendously. Her son often wonders why God has made him and his mother so unfortunate. He, of course, is suffering, and because he is so angry, he tries to make life miserable for everyone else as much as he can. He often goes out of his way. See, sometimes, to the degree that someone is obnoxious, to the degree that they are painting within themselves, or to the degree that they are dysfunctional within themselves. It's like we know that many of the abusers or child abusers, that they have been abused themselves. And so some of what it comes out is the dysfunction, some of what it engenders this kind of behavior is the pain that the individual is feeling within him or herself. He often goes out of his way to inflict pain on others. His mother is sympathetic to his sickness, but she wonders, how her son could abuse his free will to such an extent. There's a mother out there whose son is extremely depressed. Not only is he always sad, but he seems to be most miserable when everyone else seems happy and excited. He often complains to her about bringing him into this miserable world. He frequently speaks about committing suicide, and he's tried to do this, take his life several times. His mother, who loves him so much, wonders how her son could abuse his free will to such an extent. And one or two more sections. I particularly picked this short reading because we have to go to Gitanagari in a little while. Then as a divine mother, there is a divine mother out there who is most nurturing and compassionate. She watches her son experience moods of anger and confusion. She tries to remind her son and daughters why and how they have been sent to this material world, which is a very intense prison. Most importantly, she explains how to get out of this prison of birth, death, disease, and old age, and desire once and for all but nonetheless continue to observe the entities getting more and more intoxicated by bread. Let me read that again. She explains how to get out of the prison of birth and death. This mother is always concerned with the unhealthy lifestyles of others. She is vigilant, anxious for the return of her children. It intensely disturbs her to see her children physically and mentally sick. That greatest nurturing and comforting mother is none other than the Divine Mother, Srimati Radharani. See, in Vaishnava Dharma, there's not just the Father God. There is Mother and Father God. Or there is God who is manifesting himself in two aspects. Because if we think of Krishna God being the sum total of all, that Hamsavasapalabo Mataksavampavati Iti Matavajangte Mam Buddha Bhavas Mambadaha. If all material and spiritual things are ultimately coming from the Lord, everything is resting upon him, like pearls strung upon the thread, Bhagavad Gita explains. So that means There cannot just be he God. It cannot just be the masculine aspect or that's existing only. That there must be the feminine and the masculine. It's like there cannot just be the feminine aspect. So the Ladini Shakti, or the feminine aspect of the Godhead, is Srimati Radharani. And so that is the internal potency, that is the pleasure potency, that is the ultimate devotee potency or devotional potency. And so, just as in Catholicism, one is praying to Mother Mary for the blessings, to be able to get the mercy of Jesus. So this is really a reflection of ancient Vedic culture, where one is praying through the agency of Srimati Radharani to be able to be blessed by the totality of Mother, Father, God of Krishna. And so it's explained, without the mercy of Lord Nityananda, the original guru, without the mercy of Srimati Radharani, the topmost devotee, that entering into the Goloka, the transcendental realm, where there is the personal reciprocal association with the Godhead. Not where one is entering into the heavenly state, where there's the association with the Godhead and the Aishvarya, or the prominent, dominant, autocratic mood of God, the controller, and the ultimate Monsieur Annihilator. That is a certain level of God consciousness. It's like you respect someone who has power and has authority and has etiquette. But in a more intimate relationship, you should put that etiquette and power and position aside. The judge, who is in a very, very official position, relegating, determining people's life and death sentences and fines and whatever, is to be respected of a certain etiquette in the court. And if not, it can even be, you know, an offense. And that is a relationship of appreciation. But a more intimate relationship is a relationship when the judge goes home and his little grandson or granddaughter jumps on his back and rides him like a horse. It's the same judge who has spent so many years in studying, so many years in officiating, who is respected and even sits very high and gives out sentences that affect people's lives. But the granddaughter, grandson is not thinking in those realms, that this is the judge and I shouldn't be on his back. As a matter of fact, the grand little grandchild even gives the judge a slap on the face. And the judge doesn't say, so guard, take him away or fine him. No, the opposite. The judge smiles and is excited that there's this exchange with his loving granddaughter or grandson. So there is a level of God consciousness where there has been following of rules and regulations and rituals and austerities and vrats and vows and so many things. And that is done ultimately to come to a level of spontaneous love and service that is lawless, that is not bound by the position of autocracy, or is not bound by a position of superiority in the sense of God as the top controller, but where one doesn't even think of God as the controller, but as their greatest friend, their greatest lover, the greatest child, etc. So there is Vatsalya Ras, but one has a chance to have eternal service with the Lord as a parent in the mood of being able to be the parent of God. There is a level of God consciousness where one can act and serve as a friend of the Lord. And there's a level that's quite profound, esoteric, where one can be the lover of the Lord. And so here, this position of the greatest mother, Srimati Radharani, she personifies and represents this highest exchange of loving service and where there is this intimacy of spiritual conjugal association. So I end with this. As we're looking at women in general, we're looking at mothers, and we're engendered to speak on this particular meditation due to our wonderful little girl that we had a chance to give grain to, and mainly as a way to draw our attention to all the amazing qualities that girls and women have, and at the same time, how so much of that is abused, misused, not understood, or not allowed to flourish based on the nature of mature society, and how everyone suffers because of that. Just like if I have an issue with you, or I minimize your existence, or I'm exploitive or prejudiced, well, I'm also dehumanizing myself. Because in order to project that on you or to hold you down, I have to hold myself down. I stagnate some of my own self in trying to hold you down. So where men are afraid of allowing women to express themselves based on being women. Now, we're not saying that women should do all the same thing men do any more than men should do all the same thing that women do. No, we talked about the importance of diversity, healthy diversity. Women should not give up their femininity in order to trying to cope with a world that's very aggressive and also very macho. Or should they deny being women and just decide, well, you know, if I can't find a woman, I'll find a woman. Because a certain aspect of gay community is because of that. Woman who's battered, woman who's had so many men who disappoint him, and the nurturing has come from other women, and she finds herself being drawn in sexually in other ways to other women. So no way are we anyway trying to campaign minimizing etiquette. Well, we want to minimize the importance of diversity or heterogeneity. But the opposite, that diversity and heterogeneity is so important, especially when it's honored by the culture of love. And then where there are the differences, then each person can be encouraged in his or her service based on being able to give the best of what they can offer. And this is the significance of the Varnashram Dharma system. We're more interested in Devi Ashram or Bhagavad Dharma. But Varnashram Dharma system was geared, it was stratification to allow people with different tendencies to be recognized and encouraged based on those tendencies. Now, you can see that can be turned into a caste system. People can be forced, or people can be imposed on in certain ways, or they can be minimized based on something that they have or don't have. It's like now, I would be considered handicapped. Is that I'm amputated and I can't walk? And so, if you treat me like I can walk, that would be unfair right now. I mean, there's certain things I have to compensate for because I'm not able to walk. And that's just natural. And so, to minimize that, you minimize, you know, my existence at this point. I mean, four weeks from now, I'll be dancing. But right now, you know, I'm in a certain state of being. So it is important to recognize situations to be able to see best how to assist and how to serve. If you tell me, well, you know, Asian people, African people, European people, they're all the same, and you think of them all the same, that's crazy. People are different, and they have different propensities and tendencies. And as you recognize that, without any kind of illness, ill will, then we're able to allow, you're able to, what do you say, able to appreciate that person more, and they appreciate you more, you're able to work more in terms of their well-being. And so if someone is handicapped, we recognize their situation, and then we arrange things based on that, appreciating what they can do, what they can't do, etc. So there are certain things that women do better than men. Some of these men do better than women in some categories. But it has been shown that when women and men can complement each other, everything becomes better. For instance, a man who has a good wife lives longer. A woman who has a good man also lives even longer. And what to say of what they can bring together in raising the child. Beyond a doubt, when one is only raised by one parent, it is not the same. How good the man may be in trying to be the father and the mother, how good the mother may be in trying to be the mother and the father, it is not the same. Because the child will be missing something in that experience. And so how important it is then if people are going to be together, for them to be together, but they're not just tolerating each other. Or they're not just trying to compete with each other. Sometimes you have a very sharp man and a sharp woman, and the relationship is so much based on competition. And then it becomes so incoherent because where they both have so much to be able to give and to share for the family, for the community, they practically sabotage each other. Or where one has talents and they're not encouraged to use those talents, then in any case, if something's not used, it dries up. Or when it has a chance to be used, then there'll be a big problem. So it's very significant, and this will be more and more discussion in our own institution, all around the world, more and more the role of women and the role of men. Because there is a problem in just existence itself in relationship. There's so much problems in man's inhumanity to other men. And that inhumanity is especially expressed on the weaker or on the less dominant so-called agencies, children and women. So when men are so much aggressive and exploitive toward each other, they're naturally going to be as or even more exploitive toward women and toward children. And when men have a better relationship amongst themselves, then they will bring that into all the environments that they associate in. And that is also why it's important for men to do men's things together sometimes and women to do women's things. Because there are certain things that men are able to give other men in helping them to be more whole. And certain things women are able to give other women. So that when they do come together as men and women, that they bring more of a wholeness into that environment. So I end with this. The great nurturing and comforting mother is none other than the divine mother, Srimati Radharani. She is the Ladini Shakti, the divine internal pleasure potency of the Lord, and the eternal mother God of all creation. See, this Vaishnava Dharma is so unusual that it gives so much emphasis to the Ladini Shakti. And the topmost, if we can categorize, servants or devotees are known as the gopis, and they're in female expression. Now, I'm not bashing men. I'm very happy to be a man. I love the perks I get from being a man, and life has been good being a man. And how many other lifetimes I've been a woman? How many lifetimes the men have been women, the women have been men. We've all been thrown in and out of these bodies for constant stuff that we have to learn. And so where, and this is what's extremely key, is that even in spiritual communities where we have too many men who are not sufficiently balanced, not only would they make what is called Vaishnava Aparad, but it will be necessary in their next life for them to come in a woman's body. So they can have to work out and experience certain things that were not sufficiently understood, accepted, and appreciated when they were in the other body. So it's very significant in trying to go back to the kingdom of God, one to have a proper balance of the masculine and feminine aspects of their own being. For all of us have so many masculine and feminine genes, whether we are more dominant as a male or as a female. Notice the great saints and the great acharyas had a tremendous balance The Prabhupada was so small in stature in terms of his, you know, his physiognomy. He was very short. Same time, he was very, very powerful, like a lion. At the same time, he was very nurturing. As we said, Prabhupada emphasized, like a Bengali mother, like a Jewish mother, like an Italian mother, etc., etc. I have I'm African American. I have a Italian side to the family. I have a Native American side. So, in many ways, I'm always thinking about in a cosmopolitan way. So our own integration is very significant for our own spiritual success. As we're to be caretakers of others, it means we also have a duty as stewards, as best as possible, try to live our lives and to encourage others to be as balanced as possible. And when not, then we should realize that we're in a suffering condition and someone else is cheating themselves by not being sufficiently balanced. The divine eternal pleasure potency of the Lord and the eternal Mother God of all creations, who is simultaneously the same and different from the Father God. She is amazed at how we have constantly turned our backs on our own wonderful home in the spiritual world. She offers and maintains this environment for us. Especially as we go through our chronic sicknesses and suicide endeavors, it pains her to see us in difficult positions that we have created for ourselves. She constantly prays for our well-being and even makes so many arrangements. So this is position of some of the services of Radharani, the Divine Mother. She makes arrangements for our return to our family where we no longer abuse our free will. Abuse of our free will is our most serious problem. All things have been lovingly arranged for us, but we have constantly avoided taking them, for granted. Exploited them. Exploit the profound mercy that was made available. And then I end this by, Dear Divine Mother, I am the beggar, one of your sons, who is an offender in all of these areas that have been mentioned, and even more. Please forgive me for denying, avoiding, abusing, exploiting your mercy. I am a poor example of a son. But the extent of your loving, nurturing, and comforting is beyond my comprehension. Please do not give up on me, even though it is I who keep abusing my free will. So, as I wrote this, keep in mind, I'm in Mexico, you know, dealing with my terminal illness, and going a little aside from my normal, you know, die to live prayers, but just looking closer at how mercy comes, looking closer at the position of the ultimate mother, at the nature of the Godhead, of being a dualistic in the sense of the Krishna and the Radharani coming together, you know, as Mahaprabhu, Lord Chaitanya. Looking also at the present issues in the secular world and, you know, and in the spiritual community. And realizing how Maya has a very interesting way in trying to create fragmentation. Prabhupada explained how, you know, very spiritual, powerful movements cannot really be affected from the outside as much as they can be affected from the inside. And so your greatest attackers are those who know the most about you, or those who become angry, sour, or dysfunctional who are in your own communities. And so it's like when there's a, you know, coup d'etat. In most cases, if it's successful, it's because it was organized by someone who was closely involved with the power, and someone who was trusted, or someone who should have been there to protect, but didn't. You know, had ulterior motivations. So the greatest sabotaging that can happen within a family or an institution really happens within, you know, its own membership. And everybody suffers, you know, because of that. Because when there is a problem in an institution or a family, it becomes everyone's problem because it's going to affect everyone. So that means wherever there is success or achievement, everyone benefits. And when there is a lack of integration or where there is some incongruities, then there's fallout. Everyone experiences that. So how wonderful it is when we keep the family model and we think of a wholesome family that is definitely variegated, diverse, but each person is being encouraged based on what they can bring, what they bring, you know, to the table. And in some healthy families, you find that. You find that the men, the husband, is responsible in certain areas, and he's given the major dominance in those areas, and the woman is responsible in certain areas, and she is the main one responsible to see that those things happen. And therefore there is a distribution of activities or distribution of labor where each partner can do what he or she is to do, and then they share that, so more is done, more is accomplished. Where the woman is trying to do everything, control everything, there'll be a problem. Even if she does it good, she's going to have a man who feels disempowered and may even eventually look for a woman who allows him to be able to exert himself. And a man who's exerting himself in all of the areas is going to be blown out, drained out, disappointed, because he's not going to be able to have a real partner who is carrying out her role and responsibilities to make the whole family better. So sometimes people have to be more honest with each other and looking at what things that they feel more they're ready to take more responsibility for, and to be clear about what they are to be accountable for as well as the other partner. After all, marriage is a partnership, and a partnership means there is some good partnership, there is some clear goals, there's some clear mission, there's some clear vision, and there's accountability. And at the end of the day, you have greater productivity. And the major manifestation of that productivity is that you'll see it in the children. Where there's such an environment, then these little girls or little boys will be so nicely supported by the family and also by the community. So we're happy to be able to give Rebati Prema the grain today. Beautiful little girl, full of energy, dynamic. Already you can see it. And so let us all raise our own standards so that as these children grow up, they have more of a support system. And as they grow up, we have more chance to protect them, to guide them, and to keep in touch the wonderful gems that they come into this world to share. As we do that, then we leave an amazing, amazing legacy. And life has so much to do with how we're able to reach out and to touch someone else's life. So I thank you all for coming. We'll take a few short questions. But we wanted, there was a desire for some of the men, if possible, to go up to Gitanagri today. There's a festival coming at the end of the month. And there was a desire for a few things to be done with some extra manpower. So if some of you can take a half a day to go up with us, we would love it. I'll go for a day or day and a half, but I have to come back here for most of the month for therapy. I have prosthesis and I have to learn how to move in it. I just got it the other day. And I'm getting so many clinical tests, and every few days I'm in the clinic or in the hospital or therapy session or chiropractic or this or that. We're trying to use all of this in some way to prolong this existence in this body. We don't know how long we have, but the important thing is, we said the other day, live until dying. And even die before dying, in the sense of to put things that are priorities in place and to be more mindful and conscientious and appreciative of whatever moments and time we have, you know, to be able to associate. So that's why most of this series of discussions I'm having every Saturday is mainly focusing on preparing for the transition, preparing for the biggest test. Our life is about the little tests we take, getting ready for that ultimate test of leaving the body, which determines if we can go back to the Godhead, or determines if we completed what we came to this world for. None of us are residents here. We're all visiting. We're all in school and taking our different examinations. And at different times we have, you know, the Maha examination, the great examination. And we will be able to be as successful with that examination based on the quality of associations that we've had, based on the degree that we've internalized guidance from the Shastra, the scriptures, and from sadhu and saints, and from mentors, you know, from guru. All of this and the samskaras and the rites of passages are designed to help us at those most important times when we have to now, you know, to put it all up, to call in, and to be, you know, to be evaluated. So as we are more wholesome and more complete within ourselves, greater chance for acceleration, and greater chance that we're able to reach out and touch someone else's consciousness that then feeds back into, you know, our own consciousness. Any questions? Yes. Is there a microphone?
You're mentioning the statistic that one third of women are sexually abused in this lifetime. And often
these are girls.
These are girls.
Girls, yes.
And often it goes from mother to daughter. And often the male children of this of these relationships do not become proper sons. So as a woman who may have been sexually abused, you know, as a child, as a woman growing up, how do these women, as materially and spiritually, overcome these things so they can raise proper children to be able to be proper sons and proper daughters?
Well, there are several issues that are significant in the process, and I'll give one or two. First is forgiveness. Forgiveness doesn't mean, of course, that what someone did wasn't bad. Doesn't mean that you were wrong. It doesn't mean that it, you know, one must forget. But it means that the person is ready to live in the present and live for the future. We do not forgive. We hold on to the past. We allow it to keep haunting us. And we kind of experience the difficulty again and again and again every day. We're letting whoever assaulted us, abuse us, and wants us to abuse us day after day after day after day. So one started to recognize that the abuser is sick, and therefore it's that person's horrible fault and difficulty with their own life that they have dehumanized themselves in such a way. And so one shouldn't minimize their own quality or feel that they were responsible or even hold this tremendous anger. Because we hold such anger, we hold it in. I get examples like holding a hot rock. You don't forgive somebody, it's like you're holding a hot brick or rock and just waiting to throw it at someone. In the process, you're burning your own hand. You're suffering. You're taking away from what, you know, what one is or can be in such a way. And as Vaishnavas, we are to be merciful. See, forgiveness doesn't mean the what? Just like in a very highly astute spiritual government, the leaders would chastise according to the quality of the crime. Forgiveness is there, but after chastisement. Because if there's not rules and laws to address what was done, then it has a way to perpetuate the same kind of activity. If there's not forgiveness, then there's less chance, you know, for rectification. Because how much you want to make a person suffer, you know, before you feel okay? You want to see a train run over them, you want to cut them into 10 pieces, and then you think, okay, now I forgive. I mean, how much, you know, and to have that kind of mentality within oneself is not wholesome. So the system would be that according to the assault or the crime, there should be justice or a righteous punishment, because that erases the karma from that. And then, you know, then there's forgiveness. Where there's too much of a liberal mood of just minimizing the crime, then the crime becomes more and more accepted as part of the normative scheme. When it's excessive dealing with the crime, when the punishment is greater than the crime, then it creates such an imbalance in how to deal with different improper activities and subordination. But there should be expedient and clear analysis of the situation with the idea of help. And so the best way to help if someone has made a crime is to make it clear that this is a crime that's not allowed, and chastisement, you know, and then forgiveness. So more things to be said, but one of the main things is forgiveness, so that that parent doesn't carry that. See, when you carry a lack of wholeness, then it means you cheat your own children and husband, because now what has happened there has become so much a part of you, and you're carrying it, and you're closing down, or you are having some areas of dysfunctionalism because of that, which now is unfair to the ones you really want to give love to, and they want to give love to you. So there are times when one has to realize, yes, what has happened, and to name it, face it, feel it, and release it. I've gained a few more pounds. They're feeding me. I lost 40 pounds. What I would suggest you do, Prabhupada has a book called The Science of Self-Realization. You go and look in the table of contents at the different topics there. They're short presentations, and you choose one of those presentations. Let me take the microphone. I want to record this.
Thank you so much, and we're
going to
pray for you because you seem that you look so wonderful.
I always look wonderful. But one point though, it's like when I was in the hospital and I was looking a little particular about the gown. I said, you know, I may be really sick, but I don't have to look sick. I gave this amazing dissertation to a group of professional women. I think at the end I talked about the importance of women cooking for the men. And they flipped. But I was also showing them the power, and that the mentality of the cook literally goes into the food. And so, you know, an integral part of keeping a good relationship is to be more concerned about, you know, what is going into your man's consciousness. And so that they should be joyful about honoring the kitchen and making it a sacred place and cooking the preparations nicely and feeding that love and devotion, you know, to their man.
I actually tried, Father.
They probably thought, yeah, we'll cook for him. We'll put some poison in the food. Have him cook 3 days and we'll cook one day. So Swami said so many nice things. At the end, we see he's just a chauvinist after all. He said, women got to cook for the men.
And that's kind of what
Tell that guy to go to McDonald's.
Yes.
We should expect it. The greatest challenge is when we have a challenge and we are unprepared. We should know that nobody can make us as happy as those who are close to us and who love us and who we try to love. And nobody can disappoint us more or can hurt us more. And sometimes people who are close to us, they hurt us and they're not consciously doing it. But it hurts. And sometimes they're consciously doing it, and we can just accept that assault, or we can try to look a little closer at what is missing from their perception. What is their particular need? Speak about this in the Spiritual Warrior 2, that, you know, any negative action, whether it's enviousness or anger or fear or jealousy, all of these things is actually misdirected love. Someone is jealous because they feel the love that should come to them is going to someone else. Someone is envious because they think that they're more qualified for the love. Someone is angry because they're feeling... And I mean, some of these things is all can be attributed to trying to look closer to see what can one lovingly do in the environment, or what can they change in themselves to allow that person not to be, you know, not to be disturbed and to act in that way. And then when it does happen, sometimes we have to be careful, especially if we're leaders, not to take it personally. And that may sound strange, because we're always talking about everything is personal. But there's a certain things that are projected on a person who's a leader. And it should be understood and accepted. Because when you are in a position of a mentor, like as you are in your congregation, Reverend has a really nice congregation of professional men and women, very sweet, tight organization, and a radio show. Is the show still going on? Okay. So she has turned her back a little bit, you know, on corporate America to try to be more of a facilitator in the communities. So when you do that, it's also like being a parent, that there are times when your children just feel that you're choking them. There are times when your children feel that they just need space or they get angry. And it's not always what you did or didn't do. It may be, but not always. But sometimes it's just part of their need to feel their own identity. And so one has to ride with that sometimes. And there are cases where when people are not being able to exert their energies according to how they feel, that the leader has to find more ways to try to give them more facility to as a way of empowering. I like to constantly emphasize the idea of servant leadership. And the servant leader really doesn't really want to lead, but because of time-wise, pass out now. The servant leader doesn't really want to lead, but the servant leader definitely doesn't want to see where needs are there that are not being addressed. So the servant leader takes the position of going ahead or leading as a way to guarantee that the facilitation process takes place. So one doesn't see so much that has to be done and wait for others, but realize there are certain specific needs. And so the individual is ready to make the sacrifice to be involved in the coordination and the facilitation, so there's more of a guarantee that particular issues and concerns are addressed. So in that sense, as a servant leader, there's always significant need within oneself to be eager and even to celebrate feedback, good or bad. Because even that critical feedback is a message that either what one is doing or the way it's being perceived is not being fully accepted by those who we're trying to serve. And many companies, you know, as you know better than I do, they bring in people to analyze and evaluate, you know, difficulties. Or they want to have open discussion, you know, amongst their trusted employers of what isn't working. And without taking inventory, and inventory means not just looking at what is happening good, but also what is happening bad or what isn't being appreciated. Some companies made a failure is due to the fact that they have so many good things happening, but they're not ready to address those areas of weakness. And at some point, the areas of weakness, you know, will just get greater and greater. Or those who don't agree, even if they're on a campaign, they will tell you something and they will go deep in looking at issues that those who agree will not. So they can really often in disguise be your best helpers, because they will look hard to find fault. Or if there's something small, they will amplify it. But even though they've amplified it, they've brought it to your attention that you can try to address. Okay, maybe one or two last questions, and then we let you eat without having to have to talk to you at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Hello, it was a pleasure meeting you. You're talking about the mother, the role of the mother. My son is adopted. He was born, and the minute he was born, he was put into my arms. Mm-hmm. That's the most beautiful gift God can give me.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. What can I do as a person, as a mother, to help him to be a better person?
Well, part of it you're already doing, because you have so much compassion and concern. You're not saying, well, my son can probably go wrong, or my son is already doing some deviation and he's just a nonsense, and, you know, what kind of institution can we put him in, you know, for rehabilitation. But you're looking at what can help him to be protected and what can guide him according to what you feel is actually best. So first, it's best that you keep working on yourself, because we're saying how much the mother will have an impact, you know, on the boy. And you try to be more conscientious about your own associations and the child's associations. However good a parent is, there are definitely distinct times in the child's life when the peer association is more prominent and formulating the consciousness. Now, if your peer associations, the peer association of the child, is similar values that you have, that means if you're with other adults who have similar values as you have, then more likely their children will have similar values, and your child will get the same kind of thing for, you know, from different sectors. So here, association becomes, you know, very important. You try to be around people of higher consciousness that will help to empower you, and try to be in those communities where your child can get that kind of knowledge and love and protection, examples, etc. Mm-hmm. Luther?
America was a great place for opportunity because the jobs didn't pay as well, there wasn't as much
interesting question. I think we should be very honest with them and help them to be more sensitive to the powers of globalization. Is that unfortunately right now, all over the world, even in you know, in little villages, people watching the same television, they're hearing the same lyrics, same promiscuous things, and so there's no way, you know, to hide. There's no way to avoid. In one recent communication I sent out, I mentioned how it's been proven that in the introduction of television, in 15 years, the murder rate doubles in every country. I mean, there's so many things that are negatively associated with some of the impact of globalization. So anywhere in the world now, you have, you know, prostitution, you have incest, you have intoxications, you know, it practically doesn't matter where you go. And in places where there is so much emphasis on the media and cinema, is that it just gradually infiltrates. And so with the, you know, the tremendous use of the internet, you can give your child amazing external protection, and they're upstairs or downstairs on that computer, and they're all over the world. And the more intelligent that your children are, because you gave them a very good education, the more clever they are for exploring. And so they send them to the best schools in India or the best schools here or there, and that child will get on the computer and will be internationally perceiving this and that. So we should let them know that wherever they go, there will be problems. But if they're fixing a mission, it's always good, you know, to try to honor that mission. You know. And if they feel the need, going back and forth, because sometimes that kind of diversity can be healthy also. But where one may think they put their child in a prep school or send them to this place or to the village, no, there has to be more education and understanding, because wherever anybody's children go now, you know, there's danger. Danger from what they internalize, danger from other people, you know, they're going to have to deal with. And this is one of the downsides of technology, advancement of technology, centralization, commercialization, and globalization. So many good things are also there. I mean, now you can get on, this, for instance, the last class we gave on one of our websites, like 500 people, you know, heard the lecture we gave on Sunday, on Saturday. And then, it's because we're filming for our cable TV, and so thousands of people are just hearing discussion that we're just having now. So now by technology, this is available, that we can do all of this discussion, and, you know, tens of thousands of people on DC cable are hearing, you know, this discussion. At the same time, we're just in the living room, and we're sharing in such a way. So there are many good sides and, you know, downsides also. But if they think about that a little closer, they realize the important thing is wherever they are, to create more, you know, of a secure circle of associates, and for them to align themselves more, you know, with a spiritual mission. And then hopefully their children will take up the same kind of spirit. So I think we'll stop now and let you have peace while you're eating. And I'll be back either tomorrow or maybe tonight. Maybe it's too much endeavor to go up and come. I'll be back tonight. I'll be back tomorrow. And I'll be here until the 23rd. And then 23rd afternoon or 24th morning, I'll go to Gitanagri for some time. But I'll be back and forth because most of my treatments or visitations of the clinics and hospitals, you know, are here. Okay. So, you know, just keep in mind, each of us can make a difference, and we all have so much more impact on others than we ever realize. Those of you who are parents or will be parents, that you are, you know, establishing what the future will be. And it happens even before, of course, the child comes out, because while the child is in the womb, so much of the integration of consciousness is already taking place. It happens even before procreation. Because the consciousness, when you enter into procreation, is going to draw a certain type of soul. So this wonderful little girl and some of the other small children that are coming into the community, Prabhupada had mentioned how we'll see some very special qualities, the children of our children, first generation, and then the second, then the children, and so Gauravani's daughter is in that generation, that we'll see very empowered entities. And how wonderful it will be when they have the environment that allows them to be able to, you know, to access and to use what they have. And a tremendous embarrassment or will be unfortunate for our activities in trying to raise consciousness. We have such beings who then get shut down because of our lack of ability to encourage them. When you have someone who's very powerful and they're being stagnated, what happens? They become powerfully destructive to themselves and to others. And so there's this, you know, there's this big risk. When you are quite devotional and you have a very devotional husband and devotional wife, and you're also procreating based on powerful rituals, you're going to bring in very strong, empowered entities. And if you don't give them the proper guidance, then with that power, they're going to give you hell. Because that energy will be then projected first on those who are closest to them, and the, you know, and then on the environment. You know, if it's not used and channeled in the proper way. Think about the difference between the asuras and the asuras. The difference between, say, the devas, the angelic or the demigods, and those empowered for destruction. You know, like the demonic class, is that in each case they have power. They have paranormal powers. In one case, there's piety. In the other case, there's impiety. So where we have these very powerful beings coming forth, if we are not able to allow them the proper protection, especially, they'll become like impious with all the power that they have. When they take the sense gratification, they will be big sense gratifiers. When they come to manipulation, they'll be big, big manipulators because, they'll, you know, they'll have that shakti. Iskan found the child that Siddha Prabhupad ki. She see Radha Gopinath ki. Radha Madan Mohan ki. Hare Krishna.
It's all this back to you, Maharaj.